Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the new episode of the Calcioland Podcast. And today's episode is brought to you by our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game. They have a brand new Champions League fantasy competition that I checked out. It's a lot of fun. You can set your team with just players in the Champions League, and you can do that at fantasy-champions-league.com. I look forward to seeing your teams. Feel free to tweet us at the Calcioland team, your squad, so we can see what you got. So today, because I'm in Italy, I'm actually recording in an Airbnb here in Padova. Great friend Alex is in Boston. I figured we'd do a quick roundup of what's going on at the top of the table in Serie A, name our winners and losers of the weekend in Serie A, and close on the big Douglas Costa controversy that has taken over Twitter. And that will be the end of the calcio portion of the podcast. The second part of the podcast is an interview I did with our friend Andrew Barker from Variety. We previewed all the movies in the fall and the winter that are coming. We recorded this when we had Andrew on to talk about Inter a while back. There's no calcio talk in there, but if you're a fan of movies, I think you'll really enjoy that. As you guys know, I'm a failed movie critic pretending to be a calcio analyst, so it was a lot of fun for me. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our great friend, producer, co-host, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, I figured we'd catch up today on what's going on at the top of the standings in Serie A. A lot happened over the weekend. So let's start talking about two teams that had, different levels of expectations going into the season and that are definitely stumbling. We have talked a little bit about Inter and Roma in recent weeks, but it hasn't gotten any better for them. So we had Inter with a shocking loss at home against Parma in front of 60,000 fans. I was watching the game here in my apartment. I was on the chat with my colleagues on Di Marzio's site. And a few minutes before the goal, I was like, you just can feel a shocking Parma goal coming. Next day, we had Roma, who were up two goals and were caught up by Chievo. I like to joke that Sarri's been absolutely flawless at Chelsea, except for his take that in Serie A, you go up two goals, it's insurmountable. Since then, that's been proven to be untrue many times. But aside from that, Sarri, as I'm sure you are very happy with, Alex, has been flawless. So let me ask you, simply put, based on what you saw this weekend, who do you think is in more trouble between Inter and Roma?
Well, David, to answer your question properly, who am I more concerned about, especially based on their standard? I'm more concerned about Inter. And I do think Inter will finish ahead of Roma, but that's because I think Inter is just a better team than Roma. I've talked about it a lot. I think Roma has a nice collection of parts, but to me, they're a collection of parts that don't really fit together all that well. I rate Eusebio Di Francesco, but I've talked about it. I think this is going to be a tough team for him to manage. So I'm concerned about Roma, but I also didn't think Roma were going to do that well. In fact, I pegged them for sixth place. So I'm more concerned about Inter based on their standard. There is no way Inter should be losing 1-0 to Parma at the San Siro. They stumbled out of the gate to start the season, but we all kind of chalked it up to, it's a new team, let them gel together, better days are certainly ahead. Then they won 3-0 before the international break, and it really looked like it was headed the direction we all thought it was going. But they lay an egg like that on Saturday, and it does make me think, maybe this is going to be a tougher job for Spalletti than we all thought. It still is a lot of new players on his team. Now, I thought that wasn't going to be a problem because mainly they were all Serie A players who just needed to get used to a new team, not a new league. But still, this is now starting to look like a much tougher job than I maybe thought it would be. And now the toughest part comes along, David, and many of our guests have mentioned this in the interview segments. They have also, just like you and I, predicted that Inter would be second in Serie A this year, but a handful of them did mention that it would be interesting to see how Inter handle being in the Champions League as well this year. And now the Champions League is here. Inter only have 4 points in Serie A, and now Spalletti needs to figure out what team to put on the pitch midweek and at the weekend, and he doesn't really know his best team anyway. So this is going to be interesting. I am now much more concerned about Inter than I was right before the international break. And that may in and of itself sound like I'm being a prisoner of the moment. But no, maybe I'm just starting to realize, Alex, you probably should have been more concerned about them before the international break. But admittedly, I was blinded by a nice 3-0 win. So in a short amount of time, I'm really flip-flopping my take. But that's because I'm pretty shook by their 1-0 loss to Parma.
So here's my take on it. I think in the short term, Inter is in more trouble. And when I say short term, I say immediate short term. We're recording this on Tuesday before Inter's match against Spurs, as you mentioned, and a lot of our guests have brought it up. A lot of the players on Inter aren't used to playing in both competitions. They're now in the Champions League. We have to see how they handle that. And even more in the short term, Inter has had a very soft schedule to start the season. They only have 4 points. They lost to Sassuolo and Parma. Now, Sassuolo's been better than most expected. Parma, the newly promoted teams, you know, probably one of the strongest out of the three, but still, you know, they are a newly promoted team. But now they have to travel to Genova to Sampdoria. And we've talked a lot on the podcast since last year. Sampdoria is a very strong home team. So it could really go south quickly. It also didn't help that Inter now is dealing with injuries. Icardi certainly doesn't look 100%. So I'd say in the short term, Inter has reason for concern. Roma, though, you know, long term, we have to see. When we did our list of the blue chip, red chip players on Roma, there were a lot more blue chip players on Inter. On Roma, there are, you know, a few players you would definitely consider good enough to start for a team, say, as good as Juve, and a lot of question marks. So we have to see what happens. I see Roma as a team that's pretty confused right now. Di Francesco hasn't really stuck to his standard formation. Maybe he's getting a little bit desperate. I'm very concerned about Roma's back line. We talked about it when we had John Solano on the podcast. More than the new players, and I feel like Monchi's been getting ravaged in the media, I'd be really concerned about the defense. Fazio really looks like he's reverted to his form at Spurs. So not a good thing. So I'm going to say in the short term, Roma could get it going maybe a little bit more. They are more used to playing in the Champions League than Inter are, but there are some reasons for concern. So these are two teams that, you know, went into the season as expectations, you know, for competing for top four. There were some expectations that Inter could be the biggest challenger for Juve. That doesn't look to be the case. Napoli, on the other hand, I have to say, you know, into the summer, I was very concerned about them. I saw the potential for a big hangover season for them after not winning the title with 91 points, Sarri leaving and taking their identity with them. But as I was getting closer to the season and actually breaking down the squads and trying to look at it as objectively as I could, they definitely have a lot of talent. And so far, they're off to a strong start to the season. They've won all their matches. They had a pretty tough schedule. They've played Lazio, Milan, and Fiorentina were off to a great start. Their only loss was against Sampdoria in Genova, as we've mentioned, a very tough place to play. So I have to ask you, Alex, it doesn't look like we're going to have, you know, many competitors. I don't want to overreact to just four matches, but Juve is already building a big lead on Inter and Roma. How do you feel about Napoli? Do you think they can keep up with Juve? And do you think it's already too soon to maybe write off the other teams and maybe see it as again as another two-team duel like we saw last year?
I can't believe we're already here. I can't believe we're already having this discussion. But based on what we just talked about, based on the fact that Inter is very worrying, and I'm already excluding them, and this is really premature, but I'm already excluding them from second place when I was saying all summer, as was everybody, that Inter was going to be second place. And I definitely was not that down on Napoli, but I thought Inter had a better chance in second place. Now I'm at the point, David, in answering your question saying, yeah, I think it is just a two-team race. I really do. In fact, I think Napoli will be closer to Juve than maybe third place will be closer to Napoli. I really do. I'm still impressed with Napoli. I really am. They got smacked in the mouth by Sampdoria before the international break. But I think many people who were at least level-headed in that situation and weren't prisoners of the moment knew that was a lot about Sampdoria playing really well and not necessarily about Napoli being terrible or so much worse than last year. I think overall, Napoli has a real good shot at being a strong and sturdy distant second place to answer your question, can they compete with Juve? I don't think they can. And I don't even think they'll be as close as they were necessarily last year because Juve is ridiculous. Juve is ridiculous. I mean, there's just not many words you can say about Juventus that are negative because I think many people can agree. I know Juventini can agree that they haven't necessarily played attractive football to start the season, yet they're off to a perfect start. And as you've said many times, David, this is not when Allegri plays his best football. It's just not. And honestly, it's not really when the greatest managers in any sport play their best football or whatever that sport may be. Usually the best managers, coaches build up. You squeak out the results early on, and then you really build a deep foundation. And if there's anything Juve is, it's deep. Dybala obviously really hasn't hit the ground running yet. Ronaldo finally got on the score sheet. I don't think Napoli will come close to Juve, but I don't think third place at this point will come close to Napoli.
Yeah, I completely agree with that take. I was actually watching this excellent documentary on Ancelotti on Sky Sport while I was here. And one thing that really stood out to me, and he's also been saying this in his quotes, you know, one of the criticisms that you have that people have of Ancelotti is that he doesn't have a defined style of a team. And he's recently said that as much as he respected and liked what Sarri did for Napoli, his goal was to have Napoli have multiple identities, be, you know, not very predictable. As great as Sarri was, you know, after a while, you kind of knew what was coming, played a lot of the same players. And Ancelotti's goal was really to create a family atmosphere at Napoli, get more players involved. So I'm really curious to see what Napoli does. Look, last year, there's a lot of controversy. Did they purposely punt in the Champions League? I'm in the camp that they did. This year, it seems they're going to try a little bit harder, but they are in a very tough group. So even if they try, I'm not sure they'll get out of this group. And we know their president, De Laurentiis, he's in the camp that if you go being bounced out of the Champions League, it's very different than when you qualify for it altogether. So I'm curious if they're still going to be, in a way, forced to focus just on Serie A. So I'm intrigued by Napoli. The more I've seen them, the more I've looked at them, the more I'm into them, as much as I like Sarri. So let's see what happens. As you mentioned, Juve, though, is loaded. I think the best compliment you can give to Juve is they are so stacked that even if Douglas Costa, and we're recording this before we know how long his suspension is, they are so stacked that they'll be just fine without Douglas Costa. Douglas Costa is arguably one of the best players in Serie A. I always like to say I would describe him as fuori categoria, outside category. There really isn't quite anyone quite like him in Serie A since Salah left, and they are that good. But I'm curious to see what Napoli can do. I try not to be a prisoner of the moment, but when I look at the standings and what we've seen from Inter and Roma, it's going to be very tough for them to come back into the mix.
Yeah, Napoli getting a 1-0 win against Fiorentina on Saturday is a great result. It's a really, really good result. So, David, let's move on to our wonderful, I should say Monday segment, but we're doing this on a Tuesday. Let's do our winners and losers from this last weekend in Serie A.
Okay, so some of our winners and losers you can probably figure out from our intro segment, but there were more standout performances in Serie A. So on those that you kind of already heard on, I won't harp too much and expand on the others. A big winner has to be Parma left back Di Marco. I tweeted the minute he scored that goal that it was like seeing a Roberto Carlos sighting at San Siro with that goal. Interestingly, he is an Inter youth product who was loaned out to Parma, scores his first goal in Serie A against the team that owns his rights. That's football, as he said in the quotes. I don't think he would have wanted in a lot of ways to be that way, but that goal, the way it was, he has to be a winner. And congrats to Parma. That was an impressive match. I also enjoyed watching Gervinho, still that speed and that dribbling in Serie A. That's qualities that you don't see that much of. So I've been pretty intrigued with what I've seen by Parma. They also played pretty well against Juve, so kudos to them. So Napoli, of course, we mentioned it earlier. Ancelotti, to me, has to be a winner. I mentioned that he has been using more players. So far this season, he's already started 16 different players, used 19 different players, so definitely a big change from Sarri. Quick shout-out to defender Maksimović. a player that Napoli invested significantly on a few years ago. They wanted him to be Koulibaly's partner. It didn't really work out under Sarri, fell behind Albiol, fell behind even Cicedes, who is hurt, and Maximovic played pretty well against Fiorentina in his start. Shout out to Insigne, who scored as well against Fiorentina. So now let's get to Sampdoria. Very impressive win at Frosinone. I don't think anyone would have guessed that De Frel would be leading Serie A in goals along with Genoa striker Piatek. Another winner for the week with a game winner for Genoa. But De Frel, another brace. Also shout out to Quagliarella, who continues to be on fire for Napoli. We want to acknowledge to Sampdoria manager Giampaolo, who has a great track record with strikers. Last season, Quagliarella had his most goals ever in a season, although he's in his mid to late 30s. De Frel now leads Serie A in goals, so very well done there. He also made a Schick look like a mini Ibrahimovic in his first season at Sampdoria. And even Duvan Zapata had a very good season at Samp. So if you're a striker who's looking to get career back on track, try to get on a Giampaolo coach team. So now let's also give a big shout out to Chievo. We talked a lot about Roma struggling. Chievo came back down 2-0. I actually been debating a lot, my colleague Paolo Mangone on Di Marzio's side. We were talking a lot about Chievo and Bologna. He's in the camp that Bologna is better than Chievo. I pointed out to him, I don't think Bologna and a lot of other teams that are in that race to avoid relegations have two players as good as Birsa, who had a great goal there, and Giaccherini. I think that's a duo that can really take Chievo far. Interestingly, in that match, Chievo, before that match, received a 3-point suspension for some inflated plusvalenza. They were, you know, they were accused of inflating the numbers of their sales to make their books look better than they are. I was reading La Stampa, and they had this interesting quote that that match between Chievo and Roma, you know, Roma is known for a club that makes great plusvalenza, great profits. And Chievo was a team that was caught supposedly cheating on this, beat them at their game with that match. So shout out to them and shout out to Birsa, who to me is one of the most underrated players in all of Serie A. Definitely one of the most underpaid as well. Mentioned Genoa striker Piatek with another game winner. He leads Serie A in goals with De Frel. Very intriguing player at 23. I was pretty high on Genoa going into the season. I liked a lot of their other acquisitions. I didn't know much about Piatek, but he put some over the top for sure. Other winner, of course, Cristiano Ronaldo scores his first two goals in Serie A. As our friend Adam Digby wrote in an article, maybe it's not a coincidence that he got on track with the Champions League coming. You know, let's see how he does in the Champions League. That's really why Juve brought him in. But it's very important for him to get on the scoreboard in Serie A. Next winners on the match, Udinese-Torino. We have Udinese offensive midfielder Depaul, who has already three goals this season. Very talented player. They're number 10. Is getting it together this season, was pretty inconsistent before. Another player who's doing really well, we've mentioned him as a winner, I think, at least two other times, is midfielder Mete, who arrived from Monaco, had another goal. But not only that, it's also his performances in the midfield. Really tough midfielder. I like him a lot. I could see him doing really well this season for Torino and being an intriguing player in the summer. So now let's move on to the match between Cagliari and Milan. Of course, we're going to give a shout out to Higuain, who gets on the scoreboard for Milan. Really hasn't received much service, but finally scores his first goal for Milan. I also really like his grit and his determination. I think that's something that Milan really lacked as well. But Cagliari deserves a lot of credit. We had their midfielder, João Pedro, who scored the goal. He had been suspended for doping before. I don't think he had played a home game for Cagliari for quite a while as a result. But he scores the goal there. He gave the lead, which eventually was brought back. And to me, the standout player in that match was midfielder Barella, 21-year-old Italian midfielder who was linked to Inter in the summer. I think he's one of those players, kind of like Chiesa, where it's such a good thing for the Italian national team that he stayed at his current club. That way he can play regularly in a place where he's comfortable. I thought he was excellent in that match. Definitely a player to watch in the summer. Although he's pretty short, he packs a punch, plays with a lot of personality. He almost scored the second goal for Cagliari. He hit the post. Definitely a player to watch. I'm going to add him to the list of players that Mancini absolutely has to focus on. He needs to play. We need to see what he can do. I'd like to see him play next to Jorginho and see what happens there. I take him over Gagliardini any day and twice on Sunday. So those are our winners for the weekend. Now let's get to the losers. We mentioned Inter, very poor start. I mentioned it at the top. 4 points, losses to Sassuolo and Parma. Brozovic had a stinker of a match. I think for Brozovic in the World Cup, he looked great. I guess playing next to Modric and Rakitic is pretty different than playing next to the rest of Inter's midfield. I have a feeling a lot of Inter's season is going to depend on Brozovic. We saw how well he played in the second half last season and what a difference that made. Now, another team, and I mentioned it earlier, Bologna, I think they're in big trouble. They only have 1 point so far this season. Ironically, they're the only team Inter beat so far. I don't know if that says more about Bologna or Inter, but I think they're in trouble. When I look at that squad, there's really not much talent. The other person, another loser, is Roma coach Di Francesco, who finds himself on the hot seat already. I see our friend John Solano is leading the campaign to get rid of him. Might be a little bit premature there. I love John's passion. John, though, did make a really good point that I 100% agree with. All the Roma fans that are clamoring for Conte should look at the difference in salary between Di Francesco and Conte. I don't think Conte, anyways, is available for the time being until he resolves his issues with Chelsea. But an interesting situation. Let's see if Di Francesco gets his mojo back with the Champions League coming. I certainly think that would help quite a bit. Another loser, I don't want to pick on him too much because a lot of people accuse me of hating him a lot. I don't. I just think he gets a little bit overrated. Is Bonaventura, who missed two sitters for Milan in that match. I think, you know, Milan really needs Bonaventura to be more consistent. I think kind of a little bit like Brozovic, a lot of Milan's fortune depend on how he plays. And now another loser is VAR. For me, it hasn't been used enough this season. Last season, I think there were some complaints that it was delaying the games a little bit too much. But you know what? I think it's important to get it right. You have this technology. I've seen some tweets from journalists in Italy that now the referees are going to be under pressure to use it more. If you're in doubt, just go to the VAR. And I kind of agree with that. Other loser is Atalanta, who have been an absolute free fall. Not a good start for the season for them. They were eliminated in the Europa League. Haven't played that well in Serie A as well. So let's see how they do. They definitely have a lot of talent, just hasn't shown so much. I forgot to mention in the winners, clear winners is Spal. I mean, what a fairy tale game for them yesterday. They win at home. They have a refurbished new stadium that looks really, really nice. It looks like, you know, maybe not a Premier League stadium, but a really nice stadium in the championship in England, kind of that style of stadium, very functional, looks very nice on TV. They beat Atalanta, who we've done the special on them. They're known as the queen of the Provinciale, and Spal looks to be taking the competing with Sassuolo to own that title this season. Not only do they win with their new stadium, they get two goals from former Atalanta striker Petagna, and they find themselves tied for second place right now, which is really pretty remarkable. So kudos to them. Let's hope for Atalanta, who is still a great reality of Italian football, a club that's run really well that can get back on track. So now let's close on two Juve losers. I saw my friend Romeo Agresti, a great journalist that covers Juve, great on transfers, but also on covering them during the season, pointed out that Bonucci has been now responsible for three out of the goals that Juve gave up this season. We talked a lot on the podcast on how Bonucci, would bring a lot to Juve's passing game. I think maybe his defensive deficiencies were maybe a little bit overrated by those who weren't too happy with him returning to Juve. But look, if you're in that camp that he's not a good defender, it's been Christmas morning for you since the start of the season. He's definitely struggled defensively. So we have to close on Douglas Costa. And I have to tell you, I've been really thinking a lot about how to approach this because it really is a touchy subject. There's a lot of ways that I wanted to approach this. I would have liked to bring up that, you know, a lot of the people that are defending Douglas Costa's action are also a lot of the same people that are quick to point out that Totti spat on Poulsen 15 years ago. A lot of the people, when there's a debate on who's better between Totti and Del Piero, always bring up the spitting incident as a way to downgrade Totti. I also wanted to point out that, you know, there's probably a reason spitting incidents are so, so rare in football. I did some research, you know, of players related to Serie A. There really only have been four big incidents since 1990. A very famous one was Milan midfielder Frank Rijkaard, who was playing for the Dutch national team against Germany. This happened so long ago. This is when Germany wasn't unified. It was West Germany striker Rudi Völler, who played for Roma. Rijkaard was ironically called a llama because of that incident. They eventually patched things together. Then, of course, we had Mihailovic, who had an issue with this, and the Totti incident. Look, to me, there's a reason this is something that is always brought up with these players' careers. The thing, though, that bothers me about this incident is this has become a race to become who is the most self-righteous about this. And I think a lot of it is really drawn by which team you support. If you hate Juve, again, this is a great opportunity to pile on. If you're a Juve fan, you have a knee-jerk reaction to want to defend them. I think if you're a neutral or even if you're a Juve fan defending this, a lot of people will just tell you that, you know, if you're, you know, that you're just being a fan. If you're not defending this, you know, you're being told that you condone racism. Di Francesco, for what it's worth, denied that he said anything racial to it. If you want to be cynical, maybe it's possible that he only did this after he saw that maybe there's no video evidence to show what he said or whatnot. My point of view, you know, is I agree completely with the way what Allegri said after the match that, look, whatever the provocation was, unfortunately, this is a very, very sad thing that happened. It doesn't speak highly of Douglas Costa, who has a reputation for being a good person. He lost his mind. And Allegri said, whatever the provocation, this is not something that is acceptable, and he's going to be fined and he's going to be suspended. Now, is he a criminal? Is it something horrible? Does he deserve to be suspended a ton? No. You look at history, he'll probably, we're recording this before he gets the ban, he'll probably get a 3-match ban. I think Juve is handling it pretty well. They'll probably give him a heavy fine, which Allegri hinted to, but they are going to let him play in the Champions League. So I agree with Allegri's take on this. And while I really don't like what Douglas Costa did, I also applaud him for admitting he was wrong. I really liked, I looked at some of the reactions from Mihailovic and Totti when what happened to them, how they approached them. Mihailovic felt that he didn't have to apologize to Mutu, but he wanted to apologize for his behavior, not something that he wanted children to see. This seems a little bit where Douglas Costa is landing, which is fine by me. Totti also said that, you know, during the appeal, the provocations and the reason why it happened were considered, so they were satisfied. They didn't go further in the appeal once that was done. So I kind of land that way on this. I definitely think, you know, there was some cognitive bias on this. Depending on which team you support or if you hate Juve, that really takes you what your stance is. But I go back to the fact that there is a reason why this is so rare. But again, we can at least respect the fact that Douglas Costa admitted he was wrong. And I think it's better for everyone if we move on. This is definitely not the best topic to describe, to talk about on Twitter. I can tell you a lot of people, because I tweeted that I just don't justify what Douglas Costa did, regardless of the provocation. You know, a lot of people told me, well, you know, you've never experienced racism. How you would you know? You know, to give you a little bit about my background, I grew up in Italy. I grew up as an American immigrant in the 80s. I'm a half Jewish. I grew up with a lot of people that were fascist around me. I heard a lot of stuff. There were a lot of fascists that welcomed me. There's being fascist is different than a Nazi. It's not necessarily same with racism, but I can tell you that I experienced it on my own skin. So if you want to, you know, go against my character and say, how would you know? Well, I do have quite some experience. In the 80s in Italy, it wasn't that easy to grow up with this background. And this is why I've always said that I have a lot of affection for Balotelli. Just think about, you know, how much abuse he took over the years. As far as I know, he never reacted that way. But I do want to close on saying that I do applaud Douglas Costa for admitting he was wrong. And I'm fine with him not apologizing to Di Francesco. That's fine, too. So let's move on from that incident. And I don't think there's a better way to move on from this than to completely changing the subject. So we're going to close with an interview that I did with my great friend Andrew Barker on all the movies coming up in the fall. I want to take this opportunity, too, to thank all our listeners. This week, we're kind of doing a short programming with me in Italy. We're going to do Twitter questions next week again, come back with a full slate of Calcio episodes. As always, we appreciate your support. If you dig what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes. It only takes a few seconds to leave us a 5-star review. We really appreciate you tweeting about your podcast to your other followers so they can join in the fun. So thanks again, and let's close with Andrew Barker. And the magic of podcasting. A few weeks ago, you guys heard Andrew Barker, our great friend, senior features writer at Variety, come on the podcast, talk about Inter, compare Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins to Bob Bovieri. And now a few weeks later, you're listening to us talk about movies. There's no Calcio talk on this part of the interview. So we did the first leg about Calcio, and now we are in Andrew's wheelhouse. So I feel like I just talked to you, Andrew. So welcome back to Calcio Land.
Yeah, man, it's been a while. Yeah.
So let's talk about movies. And, you know, the best time of year for movies, the fall, winter, is about to come. We talked a lot on previous episodes about the Oscars. I thought last year was an incredibly strong year for movies. This summer, I have to be honest, I didn't go to the movies once. There was nothing that really dragged my attention. I thought last year we had some event movies. We also had a movie like Dunkirk that kind of appealed to all types of audience. You covered this for a living. How would you rate this summer movie season? Was there something lacking, or was it just because there wasn't a huge movie anchoring it that maybe we're underrating what happened?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think looking at it in the broadest way, I think anytime you get like two big blockbuster summer movies that are really, really excellent and special in the same year, it's hard to complain. And this year, I think one of the problems was we got two really great giant summer blockbusters. Only one of them actually came out in the winter, and that was Black Panther. So I agree. Yeah, it felt kind of barren. And really, the new Mission Impossible was the only one I could think of that really blew me away this summer, where I actually thought, okay, I got to go see that again. And it would have been different if Black Panther had been in the summer. Then I think we would have been looking at it in a rosier way. But you're right. I mean, there were a lot of big films this summer that made tons of money, that got plenty of audiences worldwide. But a lot of them just felt like they had virtually no cultural impact whatsoever. You know, like you had the new Jurassic World, you had The Incredibles 2, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Deadpool 2. Like, tons of people saw these movies, and everyone kind of liked them fine. But, I mean, did anyone actually want to talk about them or see them again? Like, you know, how many times did anyone come up to you, like, at work and talk about Jurassic World movie? Like tons of people saw it, but no one cared.
Zero.
Right, exactly. Dude I know actually put this out on Twitter. He said, you know, okay, Jurassic World, the first one, is one of the highest grossing movies of all time, of all history. Can you name any of the characters in that movie? And it's like, no, not a single one. So it's product, and it's product that's generating the money it needs to generate, and everything's fine. But yeah, it was really missing anything that you felt you had to see other than Mission Impossible Fallout, which you should absolutely see. But I think one interesting side effect, though, is that in the absence of anything worth talking about, you did have some pretty interesting movies like Blindspotting and Black Klansman and Sorry to Bother You that, I mean, obviously they weren't like challenging the Avengers for box office or anything, but they got a decent amount of attention and it felt like they were really driving a lot of conversation. And those are the movies that you don't typically see released in the summer, and you don't typically see them kind of create a moment in the summer because the summer is dedicated to, you know, even a Dunkirk, which, you know, while a legitimately great piece of work, it is a big, loud, you know, summery movie. So it was cool to see those movies get that sort of traction, but I think the absence of anything really meaningful within the summer blockbuster season had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say Black Panther, because I felt the season right after the Oscars, there were quite a few good movies, and then after that, it dropped off. So let me ask you, one of our listeners who sends us always in questions was very excited that you were on, and he wants to ask you, where do you see the future of the Star Wars franchise going? And I have to say, we had you on right when the one that came out last summer came on. You hadn't seen it. I saw it at first. I hated it. I watched it again on Netflix, and I actually really liked it. So tell me, where do you kind of see this franchise going? Because that spinoff Solo was a big bomb. So where do you kind of see Star Wars going? Is it going to be able to keep up with the real Space Force in real life?
Well, Space Force, yeah, is clearly the way of the future. Yeah, you know, I saw Solo and I reviewed it, and I thought it was fine. But once again, it is actually a perfect movie for this summer in that, you know, while that one didn't do as well as some of these other blockbusters, people saw it and just no one really cared. I mean, so I think they're running right now into, well, I think they're confronting a lot of different issues, which is one, there's this small yet very vocal gaggle of idiots who really hate the fact that Star Wars has like women and Asian people and black people in it now. And they're like really active on social media. You know, they're harassing the directors and the actors off of Instagram and things like that. And so there's this weird anti-Star Wars groundswell, which I think is just a few people, but they make it impossible to avoid them. You know, that kind of just sours the conversation, and it makes it Star Wars into something that you don't want to get into. You don't want to talk about like, oh God, Star Wars, this debate. And then the other thing, which I think was demonstrated by Solo, is there was so much excitement about bringing the franchise back. And, you know, those first two movies did so incredibly well that they might have overestimated just the sheer amount of these movies they can make, you know. I mean, you can't expect people to be this excited about a Star Wars movie when it's the third one they're getting in like a year and a half. So I think they're definitely, you know, they had all these plans for, you know, a Boba Fett movie and just all these millions and millions of spinoffs. And I think they're really scaling or thinking about scaling that back, which would be, just from a business perspective, the smart thing to do, because you don't want people to, I mean, you want these to still feel like events. You want people to be excited. And they're really kind of risking squandering that excitement, I think.
I totally agree with that. Like, basically now the plan was to have either, you know, one every year between the spinoff and the actual series. So yeah, definitely feels like too much. Now, another topic I wanted to ask you about, and you tweeted about this and I found it very interesting, is now the Oscars have a separate category for outstanding achievement in popular film. You know, last year we had Get Out be nominated for Best Movie. I think, you know, in general, Hollywood, ever since Dark Knight wasn't nominated, have been trying to kind of compensate, trying to put more popular movies. After Dark Knight wasn't nominated, they moved to 10 nominations for Best Film. And now I feel like they're going a step further with this separate category in Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film. So give me your take. Do you like this change? Do you think this is a good idea?
No. Not at all. You know, when they first announced that, the reaction was pretty much universally negative, and that was a couple weeks ago. And you know, I hadn't really thought about it that much since then. And thinking about it now, I actually think it's an even worse idea. Like, it's just a phenomenally misguided idea for several reasons. The first being, and I'm not the first one to note this, but there's already a reward you get for making extremely popular blockbuster movies. And that reward is you get millions and millions and millions of dollars, you know? So it's almost like, it's like complaining that IHOP doesn't get nominated for a James Beard Award or something. You know what I mean? Like, oh, these elitists, you know, with their Jose Andres and Thomas Kellers. It's like, no, it's IHOP. Like, you're just trying to sell a lot of pancakes to a lot of people, and you're rewarded handsomely for that. So that's one problem. And also, I think the idea that the Oscars only rewards these tiny little obscure esoteric indie movies is completely wrong. I mean, you look at Lord of the Rings, Titanic, Braveheart, Chicago, Argo, The King's Speech, Gladiator, Dances with Wolves, Forrest Gump, The Departed. All of these were extraordinarily popular films. Some of them were the most popular films in their years, or at least definitely in that top 10, and they all won Best Picture. And even when you look at some of these years where a much smaller film has won, there's always a $100 million plus film in the nominations, at least. So it's not like they're getting ignored. You know, it's actually far less common for a tiny, scrappy little movie like Moonlight or The Hurt Locker to win than it is for a much larger budget, big studio production. And three, I have a colleague named Daniel Holloway at Variety who wrote a great piece after the announcement where he got into just the amount of pressure that ABC, the network, was putting on the Academy to do something to improve their ratings, since ABC just paid a huge amount of money for broadcast rights. And that's really just where this comes from, obviously. But the thing is, like, every single televised award show has had shrinking ratings recently. The Grammy ratings are down, the Emmy ratings are down, the Tony ratings are down, the Golden Globes are down. The MTV Video Music Awards, which has never been shy about giving awards to whoever the most popular person they can get to show up, just had their lowest audience ever, just last week or whenever it was. So the Oscars are actually doing better than any other televised award show. And I think the reason that their ratings are declining and every other award show's ratings are declining is that as an entertainment product, award shows are terrible. I mean, they suck. You know, they're not very good television, and they're not very entertaining unless you're the kind of person who's already invested in it. And, you know, I mean, there's this idea that the Oscars can somehow be as popular as they were in the 90s. But, you know, these days you've got, like, everybody's got three different streaming services and a billion cable channels. And there's like 1,000, you know, Zlatan goal compilations on YouTube that you can sit there and watch. Like, so the idea that you're expecting these kids who have no interest in watching a 3-hour show with awkward speeches and weird banter to somehow show up and sit through all of this on the off chance that, like, the Avengers Age of Ultron is going to win. Like, that makes no sense. Like, the Oscars still have an audience of like 27 million people. It's still one of the most popular TV shows of the year, and it's becoming slightly less popular and will continue to become slightly less popular. But what they're doing right now is they're going all in and destroying what the whole importance that they can still claim. They're kind of diluting that in hopes that they'll attract people who are just not interested in the awards to the awards. And I think it's not the best idea. So I'm against it.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you there. So now let me ask you about a couple of movies that I'm really interested in seeing. Let's start with a pretty commercial one. The sequel to Creed, I thought the first one was really quite good, but they're losing their outstanding director, Ryan Coogler, who's hit a home run in all three movies he's made so far. Do you think there's the potential that the sequel is going to be nowhere near as good as the original because of this?
Possible, yeah. I mean, you know, one thing just for perspective is that when they gave Ryan Coogler the go-ahead to make this movie, to write and direct this movie, at the time they did that, he was this 20-something dude from Oakland who had only made one little Sundance movie before. He'd never worked on a budget like this, never worked on a franchise. So it was like a pretty significant risk. And, I mean, he knocked that out of the park. Like, I honestly like Creed even more than Black Panther. I think that's excellent.
Damn, that's bold.
Yeah, I love that. I adore that movie. I've seen that movie so many times. And so, but I mean, like, they took a chance on him, and he paid it back. And so for this one, you know, Coogler has stepped down as a director, as a writer. He's still a producer. And as a producer, he's gotten this guy named Stephen Cable Jr. to direct. And he's also a 20-something dude who only has one feature he's made, which was also a Sundance movie. So I think it's a pretty noble example of a guy who got a chance really trying to pass that same chance on. And I think that's a really admirable thing that you don't see in Hollywood that often. So for that reason, I'm going to try to go into it with an open mind. But that's it. I mean, the premise seems a little cheesy. Like, I mean, you know, now you've got the son of Ivan Drago or whatever is supposed to be happening, which is like, okay, maybe. And, you know, you got Stallone. He's back co-writing this one. And, you know, you don't want to take away from Stallone because he created Rocky. You know, he wrote all the previous ones. But I think one of the reasons that Creed was so good was Stallone actually stepped back, and for the first time he let someone else write the movie. He let Ryan Coogler write it. And I think having that distance from this character that Stallone is so protective of probably went a long way toward making that movie as good as it was. And now he's kind of back in, so we'll see if he kind of goes to some of his less interesting places. But I'm still going to assume this movie's going to be good until proven otherwise.
I'm with you on that. So let's talk about another movie that has the potential to be a big dud, and this is Bohemian Rhapsody. So this is the movie on Freddie Mercury, one of the most larger-than-life rock stars of my lifetime. So I don't know much about this movie, what it's going to be like. So let me ask you, do you think there's a chance this is going to be much more similar to the really bad Tupac movie? Or is there any chance that it's even remotely comparable to what we saw from Straight Outta Compton?
I'm going to say it's going to be better than the Tupac movie because that was a catastrophe. I don't think this could be worse. But, you know, like I people are really excited about this one. And I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. I'm cautiously optimistic. And, you know, it's interesting because I think, like, you know, there's a movie several years ago that almost no one saw in theaters called Walk Hard. Did you see that with
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, like, kind of a bomb when it came out. But I feel like it's one of those things where, like, every filmmaker in Hollywood saw that and thought, oh man, like, I don't know if I can make a music biopic the same. I mean, because it was just so vicious in savaging how cliched and cheesy that whole kind of Walk the Line and Ray style of filmmaking had become. And so I feel like after that came out, we really started seeing these music biopics that had a much more adventurous take. There was Control, which is that movie about Ian Curtis, which is really good. And there was Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson movie, which I absolutely adored. I mean, neither of them did particularly well, but there was kind of this, you know, and then I guess Last Days probably predates that, which was the Gus Van Sant sort of semi-fictional Kurt Cobain movie. But then you had Straight Outta Compton come out, which was totally in that kind of old vein of music biopic. It was not afraid of being cliched. You know, it was not afraid of doing all the things Walk the Line made fun of, but it was also super fun and it became this phenomenon. And so I think that's kind of given them more of a license to go that kind of cheesy, really kind of schematic way. So, I mean, you know, and you see the trailers and they look fun, you know, I mean, it doesn't look like this is going to be any great piece of art, but they look like a lot of fun. And, you know, Rami Malek looks incredible as Freddie, which is like 70% of the battle. So I'm not expecting a masterpiece. I'm not expecting a great piece of filmmaking. But if you just take Freddie Mercury in the 70s and go all in, go balls out with it, I don't see how that could be anything less than entertaining.
So on today's podcast, you had a pretty hot take on Creed that you liked it better than Black Panther. And look,
I stand by that. Stand by that.
Hey, you made fun of me for Birdman, so I had to give it back a little bit. So let me ask you, another time that you came on, you had a hot take that later on I totally agreed with, and that was the lead actress from Lady Bird, and I always botch her name, Saoirse Ronan. You mentioned to me that you thought there was the potential that she could be the new Meryl Streep. I then went to see Lady Bird. I absolutely loved that movie. I thought she was fantastic in that. And now she's coming out, or I think it's in December, she's going to be in the Mary Queen of Scots, you know, the type of role that could probably elevate her. So where do you see her career arch going and how this movie would fit into that?
I mean, it's a little bit of an unknown quantity because it's this director, I think her name is her first name is Josie, like Rourke Josie something with an R. Okay. Anyway, she's never made a movie before, which is why I don't know her name, but she's this very kind of well-regarded theatrical director. So it's, you know, you never know what you're going to get when someone's never made a film before, but she seems like she's got a lot of kind of high art pedigree. And I'm an English lit major. So the idea of going back to the, you know, Mary pre-Elizabethan period is very interesting to me. And as a Saoirse Ronan stan, and I really am just, I just stan for this actress in a way I do very few actors in Hollywood. There's something both interesting, because I'm obviously going to see it, and a little, I wouldn't want to say I'm disappointed, but she definitely kind of made her name doing period films. You know, first was Atonement when she was a little kid, and then Brooklyn, which I think was really her coming out as an adult actress, which is a superb movie. And the great thing about Lady Bird was just seeing her just play a like modern American teenager and do it so incredibly well. And obviously, you know, like there are a lot of actors her age who can play modern American women, and not so many who can play a, you know, imprisoned ex-queen of England or, you know, any of these things. But so, yeah, so she's doing that, which is obviously a period piece. After that, she's doing another Little Women. I think she's playing Jo. She was just on The Crucible in Broadway. So I just worry that she might do a little too much of these really kind of prestige-y period movies, because obviously she can do them well. And obviously that's the kind of thing that, you know, Oscar voters love. So I'm sure that might be a consideration. I'll see anything she's in, but I'd kind of like to see her just be more modern, because I thought she did that so well in Lady Bird. I thought that's what one of the things that made that movie special.
Absolutely. So the name of the director is Josie Rourke. So it's
Rourke,
the first
okay.
Time. Yep.
All right.
So let me. It was close. So let me ask you. We did our Oscar special, you and I, a while back. I thought it was an incredibly strong field last year. I asked you about a couple of movies, but are there any others that stand out to you that are on your radar? I know you see a lot of movies ahead of time too, maybe even some that you've already seen. Anything else that I should keep my eye out for?
Yeah, man. No, there's a lot of stuff coming down. Like, so I don't know when this is coming out, but I was like right now as we're recording, you know, the season has really just kicked off. Venice just started the other day. And then after Venice, you got Telluride. And then right after Telluride, you've got Toronto. And usually within those three film festivals over about a month, everybody gets their first look at all the movies that are going to be coming out through the rest of the fall that we're going to be talking about through the Oscars. And, you know, you never know until, you know, it's like, you know, you can't judge by the transfer market how a season's going to go. You can't judge by just the festival lineup, but this looks like a really just interesting year. You know, so Venice has already started, and we've had First Man, which is the Damien Chazelle movie about Apollo 11 and Neil Armstrong, and that got great reviews. And I mean, I'm really curious about that, because he's a, you know, he did La La Land and Whiplash, and he's a really strong, very young director. And you know, I think it's good that he's making a movie that's not about white people saving jazz, you know, because he's kind of getting stuck. but reviews are really good for that. The one, though, that it hasn't played yet, but I know a couple people have seen it and really are over the moon about it, is this movie Roma, which is the new one from Alfonso Cuarón, who is among my favorite living directors. And so this is his first Spanish language movie in decades. It's his first movie set in Mexico in a long time, I think since Y Tu Mama Tambien. Black and white, kind of based on his childhood in Mexico City, and it really sounds special. I really can't wait to see it. What else? I mean, there's just a lot. If Beale Street Could Talk, which is Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight. That's his new movie. I think it's placed Toronto. There's the remake of Suspiria, which, yeah, who knows how that's going to be.
Tom York's doing the soundtrack. I'm excited.
Tom York doing the soundtrack. It's Luca Guadagnino directing. Very interesting visual director. Like, I don't know. I hope all of your listeners have seen Suspiria. But if you haven't, yeah. It's the Dario Argento movie from the 70s. I would put that right up with The Shining and Halloween, like among like the three greatest horror movies ever made. It's tough to try to remake a movie like that, but they got a really interesting director. Like, it's one of those movies where even if it's not very good, you know it'll be bizarre and disturbing and weird, bonkers. So I got to see that. One thing that is really probably getting more buzz than anything else is the Star Is Born remake with Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. I mean, people are
I was reading about that. Yeah.
I mean, everyone seems to be excited about it. I'm kind of skeptical because it's like, I don't know, like A Star Is Born, really? Like, do we really need to make a fourth version of A Star Is Born? I like Lady Gaga. I've never, ever had a problem with Lady Gaga. I think she's perfectly talented. But this is a role that, like, Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand have done before. So, you know, it's like, you know, Boca al Lupo, I guess, you know, right? But whatever. It could be good. Shane Black making a Predator movie, which, like A Star Is Born, I don't know why we need another Predator movie, but Shane Black is awesome, so I'll see that. There's a movie called The Sisters Brothers, which is a horrible title, I'll admit, but it's this sort of a 70s-style Western by Jacques Auriard, who's a French director who did a movie called A Prophet, which is one of the best movies of the last decade, I think. Actually, it's one of Ryan Coogler's favorite movies of all time. Like, he mentions that in every interview.
That's the prison movie, right? Yeah, it's awesome. I love that movie.
Yeah, amazing movie. And so I know several people who've seen that one early, and it's pretty much 50-50, absolutely loved it and really couldn't stand it. Which is one of those things that actually makes me more interested in a movie than if just everyone loves it. Like, okay, this sounds like there's something really unique going on. And then the last one I would point out, which is kind of a crazy one, is The Other Side of the Wind, which is a lost Orson Welles movie that was shot in the 70s, has never been seen before, and is playing festivals, and it's just going to come to Netflix. So it's just going to be there. It's just like a new Orson Welles movie that no one has seen, dropping right onto your computer, your TV. So, I mean, who knows with this one? Because, like, when you get a lot of these long lost projects, like, sometimes they were lost for a reason, you know? Sometimes, like, they were never really any good and the director never figured it out. But I think anytime you get to see a completely new movie from one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lived, who died 30 years ago, I mean, that's the stuff you really hope for, you know? I mean, this summer we already got a long lost John Coltrane album, which was amazing. And so now this fall we're getting a new Orson Welles movie. Like, I love anything like this where I can watch new things, but still live in the past like I want to.
Awesome.
So good, bad, or indifferent. Yeah. Can't wait for that one.
So I'll be sure to watch that Orson Welles movie during the Oscars on Netflix so they don't get the ratings. So, Andrew, perfect. I can't thank you enough. You are tremendous, a gem. Always my favorite guest because we talk so much about movies. Thank you so much for indulging me. As always, it was a real pleasure.
Absolutely, man. Hope you're enjoying wherever you are when this airs.